Come.
I'm Christopher Cruz. The U.S. continues to pressure Israel to stop attacking Hamas positions in hospitals in the Gaza Strip. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan on CBS's Face the Nation.
The United States does not want to see firefights in hospitals where innocent people, patients receiving medical care, are caught in the crossfire. And we've had active consultations with the Israeli Defense Forces on this.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told NBC today that Israel had offered fuel to a major hospital in Gaza that has no electricity, but Hamas refused it.
Basta, basta, fratelli, basta.
At St. Peter's Square today, Pope Francis said, enough, enough, brothers, enough. He said the wounded in Gaza should be helped immediately, civilians should be protected, and more humanitarian aid should be delivered. And he said the hostages should be freed. The House is back in session tomorrow. Topic A, approving a plan to fund the government past Friday when funding runs out. American Federation of Government Employees Policy Director Jacqueline Simon says the union is not supportive of a bill proposed by House Speaker Mike Johnson.
We are very concerned about the Speaker's idea of linking a new CR to some kind of a fiscal commission that would inevitably be focused on cuts to Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid.
President Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping are planning to meet at the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit in San Francisco this week. KPIX-TV reporter Da Lin says residents are preparing for major disruptions in their routines.
The major closures don't happen until Monday.
I'm already having difficulties getting around because of the gate spinning up.
Alexandra Alver lives in one of the several senior housing complexes across from Moscone Center.
I don't think I'll be able to go out, really. I've been stocking up on my, household supplies and whatnot.
Like Alexandra, many seniors tell me they've rescheduled doctor's appointments and are preparing the week like a pandemic lockdown.
A Hillsborough County, Florida sheriff's deputy who was critically injured last week when he and a partner were intentionally rammed by a car has left the hospital. Manuel Santos pulled his gun and aimed at the suspect, he says, even after he was pinned between two cars.
I see him, I observe him, I don't see any firearms. I see him eyeball one of my partners, which is Vincent Valentine, one of my best friends. Makes eye contact with him, I hear him giving verbal commands. As soon as I notice that, that's it. It's my saving grace, right? I holstered, I flipped over to make sure I keep eyes on my partners. And then I called for EMS.
The suspect has been charged with attempted murder on a law enforcement officer. This is CBS News.
Make the hiring process work for you. With Indeed's end-to-end hiring solution, you can attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one place. Start at Indeed.com/credits.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us. Did you know this local radio station is part of Civic Media? Learn more about the entire network at civicmedia.us.
Just be natural. Try to roll around in it gracefully and not like a puppy.
Maria's photography studio is zooming into a flurry of projects.
Where did I put that memory card?
She needs an assistant to keep business in focus.
Hang on while I change the...
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. A Wisconsin grand jury has indicted a Connecticut man accused of scamming older Wisconsinites. Consumer watchdogs have some tips to avoid being ripped off. Here's Mike Moan.
Matthew Ramos Soto of Hartford is accused of stealing $200,000 from Wisconsin seniors last year. The scam was to call the victims, falsely claim to be representing one of their younger relatives who had been arrested, and that bail money was needed. The Better Business Bureau's Kristen Johnson says disengaging right away can help people avoid this kind of scam.
Put down the phone, hang it up, and call your grandchild. Do not call the number on your caller ID because scammers can spoof caller IDs. They can spoof names and numbers. Actually call that grandchild and say, did you really just call me? Are you really in trouble?
Other ways people can remain vigilant are to ask questions of the scammer that only a family member can answer, and to not wire money if there is any doubt about the call. Johnson urges anyone who's been a victim to report it on the Better Business Bureau scam tracker. Ramos Soto faces a maximum penalty of 20 years in federal prison if convicted. Though older adults are some of the more likely targets for scams like this, they're not the most susceptible to them, with experts pointing to vulnerability among those ages 18 to 24. Still, Johnson notes there are big concerns about the impact on older populations.
So while older adults were less likely to fall for scams when targeted, when they did fall for them, they lost a lot more money than someone ages 18 to 24.
Around 74% of adults age 55 and older are susceptible. In 2022, this population lost around $350 on average per scam. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
This is your hometown radio, Refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network. 93.5 The Tap. 93.5 The Tap. This is 93.5 The Tap.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Generally sunny to mostly sunny skies today at 54 degrees. South to southwest winds up to 15 miles per hour. Clear and 34 in the overnight. On Monday, sunny, 53 degrees. On Tuesday, mostly sunny and breezy. A little warmer, up to 58. It's 42 at our studios.
Tell a friend what's on tap. There's a new station in town with conversation about Chippewa Falls, Eau Claire, and the Chippewa Valley. This is 93.5 The Tap.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. You don't know me, but I'm your brother. Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning and welcome to our Saturday morning broadcast this Saturday, November 11th, 2023. It is Veterans Day in America. Veterans Day in America. This is our 71st broadcast here on the broadcast studios and stations of Civic Media throughout the state of Wisconsin. Thank you so much for joining me for this, our weekly review, our analysis, and yes, our discussion involving you as well of the most important news events, the stories, the issues in the areas of law and government, and the aspiration for justice in America, inviting your comments, your questions in all of that as well. I am supported. I am assisted, as always, by my extraordinary producer this morning, Anya. We're together today in the studios of WAUK, but once again, taking your messages, your calls, especially your questions. Delighted to have you on and honored to have you with us for our broadcast this morning. And inviting your participation, not just this morning in our first hour, our second hour, but every Saturday morning here on WAUK, the broadcast stations of other stations throughout the state of Wisconsin. We're encouraging those comments, questions, inquiries. The phone number is 844-967-2789. That phone number, once again, 844-967-2789. Anya also reminds me always that you can go onto the Civic Media website as well. Find your broadcast station here on Civic Media. Identify the Morning Cannolis folder and send us a note. Send us a text with your question or comment. As always, this morning, Veterans Day 2023, November 11th, we're going to be asking and hopefully in part answering three principal questions here in our broadcast. First, what happened? What are those important news stories in the areas of government and law and justice in America? What are the facts? What do we know with some good deal of certainty this morning? Second, why are those issues, those events, why are they important? Why are they relevant? Why are they material and significant to our lives in America and on the face of this planet to which we are all connected? And finally, most often, what can we do about those things? What should we do? What activities, what actions, what responses, what answers should we give to those things that are animating our lives here in Wisconsin, in the United States of America, and in all places on our planet? As always, plainly an aggressive but achievable syllabus this morning, hopefully for you and for all of us, informative, educational, inspiring, and perhaps even motivating when it comes to those things that we should, in fact, be doing. We'll begin with some thoughts on the connections, the ties between Armistice Day 1918, 105 years later, and the rule of law today in 2023. What does that tell us about the lives we're living today? The events of Armistice Day, we're going to visit some history on that day, and also then comment about the involvement of justice, the attempt at justice back in 1918 in the wake of World War I today, 105 years later. Then our aggressive but achievable syllabus, including a focus on an equally pensive and somber issue here. Again, here on our broadcast of this Saturday morning, we're going to be talking a lot about firearms, some major events of just this past week, including a major oral argument before the United States Supreme Court on Tuesday of this week. We're going to talk about what that meant, what that was all about, and make a prediction about what the Supreme Court is going to say in connection with its latest understanding of and even instruction on the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. We're going to be talking about a major case coming out of our own Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals just this past week, again, having to do with the Second Amendment and the intersection of constitutional rights and the interest in keeping us safe and secure in our nation. We're going to talk about something coming out of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. Again, another appellate decision having to do with the Second Amendment. And finally, we're going to chat about something that happened just about a week ago in Highland Park, just a few miles south of us here as we meet together in Wisconsin, in Highland Park, Illinois, going back and reminiscing about the horrific event, remembering the horrific event that happened on July 4th of 2022, a significant conviction coming out of that horrific event involving firearms. And of course, we necessarily have to chat this week about the ongoing continuing litigation involving our former president, Donald Trump, and his corporation, that going on in a Manhattan civil court, alleging fraud by the Attorney General of the state of New York, Letitia James. We'll talk about the testimony and do some civics, do some law school this morning on our broadcast about some of the things that the judge has done just this past week and why it is that the case continues even to this coming Monday as it moves now to a defense case. We're going to chat about a few other matters related to the rule of law this past week, involving some major prosecutions of a Gambino mob family coming out of Brooklyn, out of New York. We're going to chat about some additional convictions coming out of January 6th, the insurrection, the attempt to overthrow our government, and certainly the voting on that day. And then we're also going to talk a little bit more about what's going to happen in a week from now if indeed our United States Congress does not do what it is constitutionally obliged to do, which is put together, assemble and present and pass for the good of all of us a budget that requires that expenditures be made, that the agencies and entities, the people of the United States government that serve us, both in elected positions, but also many people in appointed civil service appointments throughout our nation, including right here in Wisconsin, how it is that we can and should support them by encouraging, by urging, by compelling our elected representatives in the United States Congress to do what they should do on all sides of the political aisle to ensure that we've got an operating budget. As you know, once again, we're facing a possible shutdown in 6 short days. We'll chat about the constitutional implications of that and the obligations upon all of us, to require, to demand of our elected officials that they do better than what they have done and pass, finally, a budget that gives us security going forward. But we're going to begin again this morning pensively, thoughtfully remembering those veterans who have been lost in the past. That, of course, usually a time of Memorial Day in late May. Today, Veterans Day, we recognize all veterans alive and who have given their lives for the service of our nation. Estimated that today we've got 18 million veterans who are still alive with us, veterans of many wars of recent times. Historians estimate there are about 40 million or so who have served in our nation's many wars going back to the Revolutionary War in 1775, 1776. What do we know about what happened 105 years ago today, called Armistice Day of 1918? We know that since Armistice Day, it has evolved this all-important observance of our veterans, of the contributions that they have made to our safety and security worldwide, and yes, domestically as well. It has evolved over time, Woodrow Wilson being one of the first presidents in the wake of World War I to articulate the need to recognize the soldiers in World War I, eventually that including soldiers from World War II and all veterans of that time, eventually through congressional action, becoming what we know today as Veterans Day in the time a time for remembrance, for historical reflection on what it is that has happened in our history. And so that is where we begin this morning in our broadcast. We remember, well, the armistice of 11 November 1918, this agreement, it was in fact a rule of law agreement, a contract, if you will, although quite one-sided, as we will comment in just a moment or two, a contract, a rule of law agreement. It was signed at La Francport near Compiègne. It ended fighting on land, as you know, on sea and on air in World War I, with the remaining opponent at that time, of course, the nation of Germany. Previous armistices that had been negotiated and put in place prior to this time with Bulgaria, the Ottoman Empire, and Austria-Hungary, all of those things preceded November 11th of 1918. This was concluding after the government of Germany had sent a message, again, to our own President Woodrow Wilson, seeking to negotiate some terms on the basis of a recent speech that he had given at that time, that speech declaring what he called the 14 points, which was his aspiration for a post-war America, a post-war world generally, later became the basis for the German surrender at the Paris Peace Conference, which took place the following year, 1919, and eventually taking effect in 2020. What do we know about this armistice, this rule of law agreement that happened 105 years ago today? We know based upon the history of the time, it was signed at 5:45 a.m. by the Allied Supreme Commander. His name is French Marshal Ferdinand Foch. And he was not only the Allied Supreme Commander at the time, that is Marshal Foch, but also the principal author, the principal person who put all this together, designed this and marked a victory, plainly for the Allies, and a plain defeat, an unmistakable defeat, although not a formally a surrender by the German government. What did that rule of law document, what did he put together at that time? The actual terms, which again written by French Marshal Ferdinand Foch, included the cessation, of course, of all hostilities on the Western Front at the time, the withdrawal of all German forces from areas west of the Rhine River, the Allied occupation of the Rhineland and some areas further east of that location, the preservation of all the infrastructure at the time, and the surrender, significantly, of aircraft and warships and military materials of the German forces, significantly also the release of all Allied prisoners of war and civilians, eventual reparations as well, an issue that we continue to talk about in other contexts to this day. Significantly also, no release of German prisoners and no relaxation of the naval blockade of Germany. That agreement, that rule of law agreement, that again, probably in many ways not only brought an end to the hostilities, certainly did that, but probably also laid the groundwork ultimately for World War II, with the German population in many ways responding to some of the very restrictive aspects of that. The armistice was extended three times until eventually the Treaty of Versailles officially signed on June 28, 1919. It took effect on January 10th of 1920. Again, a rule of law document recognizing that sometimes those kinds of contracts, those things in our history that we label as bringing to a close the most destructive thing that mankind can do on the face of the planet, that is bringing to a close war, which we, again, are experiencing today, not only in the Middle East, Ukraine, other places in the face of the planet, but also recognizing that they can be imperfect. Rule of law documents can, in fact, be imperfect, even if we recognize the importance of what happened on this day. Fighting continued up until 11 a.m. on the 11th of November of 1918. On that day, on the very day, the last day of the war, 2,700 men dying on the last day of the war. Veterans Day, 2023, 105 years after Armistice Day, 1918. As we come back right after this brief hiatus, we're going to come back and talk with you about other issues made possible in the rule of law in America by virtue of what veterans have done for us here in America and beyond.
You're listening to 93.5, The Tap.
The 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is here and ready to help anyone experiencing a suicidal, mental health, or substance use crisis. Call, text, or chat 988 to get connected to a trained Lifeline counselor. 988, here to support you. Sponsored by Wisconsin DHS.
If you love them enough to listen to them practice the same song on tuba.
Please be done.
Over and over and over and over and over. Then surely you'll check nhtsa.gov/the right seat to make sure they're correctly buckled in the back seat.
Sounds good, honey.
Check today at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Hey, son, how are you feeling?
I'm fine, Pops.
What's on your mind?
I can't explain it.
When your kid can't find the language, find the lyrics. Start a conversation at soundedouttogether.org. Brought to you by Ed Council and Pivotal Ventures.
93.5 The Tap.
We are back here on Morning Cannolis, our Saturday morning broadcast, talking about the rule of law in America, justice, and government as well. This past week, one branch of our federal government continued to be very much in operation. The Supreme Court in October, November, and December beginning its latest term of cases. Right now, about 40 cases pending before the United States Supreme Court, almost certainly to be added. Additional cases, maybe about 20 or so of those, as those are the part of the docket coming up in this 2023-2024 term of the United States Supreme Court. As we have discussed previously, among the issues with which the Supreme Court seems to be much focused on this court, things related to social media and the interaction between government and private individuals, what you can and cannot do as a government official when it comes to your own personal social media platforms, the kinds of things that government can do with respect to information, even misinformation on the social media platforms of our times. A lot of social media cases, we've talked about some of those. We'll talk about more of those in the future. In addition, a major focus this term of the United States Supreme Court on the issues of administrative exercise, the engagements that administrative agencies, all the administrative agencies of our federal government engage in when it comes to decision-making, implementing the rules and the laws passed by our United States Congress, a focus on what our agencies are doing, their capacity to do it as they have been doing, the very constitution of their and the legitimacy of their work, that also a major focus of the United States Supreme Court. And increasingly, although it has grown over the past several weeks, another great focus this term on firearms in America, including just this past Tuesday, this case called United States versus Rahimi. And that's the name of the defendant. That's the name of the case that was pending before the United States Supreme Court on Tuesday of this week for oral argument, not decision yet. That's probably going to come up in, say May, maybe even June of next year. But we know from the Supreme Court's oral argument, we've got a pretty good prediction but what they're going to be doing in this particular case. We also know that this particular decision, this particular ruling, this particular case comes up in the wake of two major cases of recent years, also involving the Second Amendment. One of those, Heller, establishing that for the first time in our United States history, you have a constitutional right, according to the majority of the Supreme Court, to possess and presumably use weapons in your home for self-defensive purposes. That's Heller way back in 2008. Written by Antonin Scalia. Just last term, 2022, in a major opinion by the majority of the Supreme Court, authored by Clarence Thomas, a case called Bruin coming out of the state of New York, a finding by the Supreme Court that constitutional right, again, for the first time in our history, also extends to public places. You've got a right to carry weapons in the public domain based upon Bruin, and very significantly in Bruin, in that case articulated, not without strong dissent on the Supreme Court, not without an awful lot of pushback in the American population as well. But in that case, in Bruin, articulating this notion that the legitimacy of federal laws, of state laws, of local laws, in any way restricting, controlling firearms in America, that is their manufacture, their sale, their purchase, their delivery, their use, all those kinds of things will be measured not by a balancing test. A balancing test that basically says that whether or not the government has a legitimate purpose in ensuring our safety and security, which the government plainly does, and whether or not the particular thing that the government is going to be doing meets that particular goal, whether it's related to that ultimate purpose. That's a balancing test. That's how we've always done things when it comes to analyzing legitimacy of litigation and legislation in our nation. Instead, what Bruin did is said for the first time, once again, when it comes to firearms, the determination about whether or not these pieces of legislation coming out of our legislative bodies, whether they're legitimate or not, constitutional or not, depends upon whether there is an historical antecedent. If you look back in history, is there something you can find in our own history, maybe the history of other nations in centuries past, that could justify, that give us a basis for supporting this particular piece of legislation that does in fact control or in some way limits access to use of firearms in our nation? Changing again the analysis. So what happens? Well, Zakeh Rahimi, as we know, in his life, the solution, it seems, for virtually every problem involves firearms. And that's not an overstatement. The court this past Tuesday not only acknowledged that, but recited, not in great detail, but certainly was taking argument in the context of what Zakeh Rahimi had done in December of 2019. As we have described previously, he fired a shot at a bystander who had seen him shoving his girlfriend in a parking lot. And then he threatened to shoot his girlfriend, too, if she told anybody about it. In another instance, when a friend of his, an acquaintance, posted something rude about him on social media, Rahimi fired an AR-15 into their house. When he got into a car accident, another incident, he shot at another driver. And when a truck flashed its signals at him, for some reason, he shot at a different car that was behind the offending truck. All of that by Zakeh Rahimi. After Rahimi's credit card declined at a Whataburger, which is a fast food restaurant, Rahimi pulled out a gun in that facility and fired several shots into the air, again, plainly terrifying the employees. This is a man who uses firearms dramatically. Of course, in the wake of all of this, local authorities do impose upon him a domestic violence restraining order to keep away from his girlfriend, appropriately done in the courts. And when all of this happens, the federal authorities finally said, well, gee, Mr. Rahimi plainly is in violation of an existing federal law, that federal law prohibiting the use, the possession, the use generally in the ways that Mr. Rahimi has been abusing firearms in America, prohibits you from even having firearms. And that federal law has been in place from our congressional legislature for many, many years, imposes a restriction upon him in the wake of his conviction for a violation of that federal statute. And the Fifth Circuit takes this case up, whether or not that prohibition of someone who's got a domestic violence restraining order against them, whether that prohibition under the federal law is constitutional. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, we have talked about this before, identified the Fifth Circuit before. We're going to talk more about something else the Fifth Circuit did in just a few moments or so. Fifth Circuit says that indeed, under Rahimi in this case, looking to the standards in Bruin, not finding any historical basis for the establishment of this federal law that says if you've got a domestic violence restraining order against you, you can't possess, you can't use weapons. And the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, again, the Court of Appeals, one of the many courts of appeals below the Supreme Court, says that the federal law pursuant to which Mr. Rahimi was convicted in federal court is unconstitutional and orders that his conviction for possessing these weapons while he is under this domestic violence restraining order is unconstitutional, has got to be invalidated. It's got to be limited and reversed. That comes up to the Supreme Court. And yes, once again, this past Tuesday, the Supreme Court entertaining argument on all of that. A fascinating argument indicating, and here is the good news. Here is the good news coming out of that oral argument. Almost certainly, not all, but certainly most of the Supreme Court justices listening to this case identify a way forward that supports the federal law pursuant to which Mr. Rahimi was convicted. All of them basically saying that this law should in fact be supported and that the Rahimi conviction should be upheld. Significantly, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson pointed out what she called a flaw in the court's decision back in 2022, this Bruin case. She and some of the other justices looking at this and saying, we need to revisit this test, looks back to history. She says, I guess I'm troubled by having a history and traditions that require some sort of culling the history so that only certain people's history counts. When we come back, we're going to talk more about what the justice meant by that, what other justices said on Tuesday of this week, and again, likely resulting in a decision affirming the conviction.
You're tapped in to the issues affecting the Valley and all of Wisconsin.
Consider us the bartenders of friendly local talk.
This is 93.5. The Tap.
CBS News Brief. Attempts are underway to secure the release of Israeli hostages held by Hamas. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan this morning on CBS's Face the Nation.
There are active negotiations underway between Israel and Qatar, who is communicating with Hamas, and the United States is involved in those discussions.
The House comes back into session tomorrow, facing a Friday deadline before funding for government operations runs out. Jacqueline Simon of the American Federation of Government Employees.
We're expecting a shutdown. We're certainly preparing for a shutdown and hoping that we don't get one.
Residents of San Francisco are preparing for major disruptions from this week's Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit.
Never been this locked down before, so you have to shop and everything before it happens.
President Biden is scheduled to meet with Chinese leader Xi Jinping at the summit on Wednesday. He'll reportedly be pushing for the reestablishment of military-to-military ties with China. CBS News Brief. I'm Christopher Cruz.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. In the NBA, the Bucks have a road game Wednesday night against the Raptors. Tomorrow night, the Bucks host the Chicago Bulls. It was a wild week for Giannis Antetokounmpo. On Wednesday, he got ejected from a game for making a mean mug to a Detroit Pistons player, Bucks teammate Brooke Lopez.
Yeah, you know, we felt there were a lot of questionable calls, but you got to fight through that. And the way Giannis got kicked out, we obviously don't think that was great, you know, or correct. But whatever, we turned it into a positive.
The next night, Giannis put up 54 points in Indy against the Pacers. Head coach Adrian Griffin on what it's like to work with Giannis up close.
You know, it's just awesome to see someone with his length, his size, his footwork, you know, unbelievable footwork. You know, he's all-time great. He's going to go down as one of the greatest players to ever play this game.
That's the Bucks head coach, Adrian Griffin. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Generally sunny to mostly sunny skies today at 54 degrees. South to southwest winds up to 15 miles per hour. Clear and 34 in the overnight. On Monday, sunny, 53 degrees. On Tuesday, mostly sunny and breezy, a little warmer, up to 58. Currently 44 degrees.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here. I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe and is the best way to protect that legacy.
Protect your legacy. Visit ready.gov/plan for the tools and tips you need to start your emergency preparedness plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
UPS Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the lingo.
Jelly. Jelly adjective. Jelly is a shorter, better way to say jealous. As in, Chloe, I am like so jelly of your unicorn phone case.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org, brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUS Kids, and the Ad Council.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Don't let biased algorithms, or degree screens, or exclusive professional networks, or stereotypes, don't let anything keep you from discovering the half of the workforce who are stars. Workers skilled through alternative routes rather than a bachelor's degree. It's time to tear the paper ceiling and see the stars beyond it. Find out how you can make stars part of your talent strategy at tearthepaperceiling.org. Brought to you by Opportunity at Work and the Ad Council.
93.5. The Tap. Tap into what Chippewa Falls, Eau Claire, and the Chippewa Valley is talking about today. This is 93.5 The Tap. Online at thetap.fm. Okay.
We're back on this, our Saturday morning broadcast, Saturday, November 11th, 2023. Thank you for joining me and my wonderful producer, Anya, here for our broadcast this morning about the rule of law, government, and justice in America and beyond. As always, we are taking your questions and comments at 844-967-2789, also soliciting and accepting your written comments and especially your questions online. Go on the Civic Media website, your broadcast station, find Morning Cannolis, and speak with us through that mechanism as well. Always delighted, honored to have your involvement in our discussion this morning, as every Saturday morning. We are talking this morning once again, necessarily, about firearms in America, not just in the wake of the horrific events in Lewiston, Maine of recent times, but also those many mass shootings and other shootings throughout our nation that continue to paralyze and terrorize our nation on a regular basis. We're talking right now about this next major Supreme Court case called Rahimi, oral argument just this past Tuesday, in which the Supreme Court justices, at least the majority of them, seemed to indicate that they were not inclined, not at all inclined, to buy the approach, the advocacy of Mr. Rahimi's counsel, that his conviction for owning, operating, using these weapons in the violent way that he did while he's under a domestic violence restraining order, that does not qualify him for a conviction under the federal law that prohibits exactly that kind of conduct. Simpler way of saying that, the law should be upheld. Supreme Court almost certainly going to go down that road. This is a very serious discussion, obviously, being had before the United States Supreme Court, a Supreme Court that, again, under Heller and Bruin recently has expanded the rights under the Second Amendment for the first time in our nation's history 15 years ago and 15, 16 months or so ago. But along the way, even in the course of this oral argument on Tuesday, Chief Justice Ron Roberts underscoring how this is not the case. Mr. Rahimi, not an especially attractive defendant, not especially attractive petitioner to be before the Supreme Court. Chief Justice Ron Roberts engaging counsel for the defense on whether or not Mr. Rahimi is a dangerous person, and determining whether or not that particular description of him should be dispositive in this case. And at some point, John Roberts, the Chief Justice, asks Rahimi's attorney concede that his client is indeed a dangerous person based upon the facts of this case known before, as I recited them earlier in our broadcast. And Roberts says this, he says, well, to the extent that's pertinent, again, focusing on this notion that we're going to move up beyond the notion that there is dangerous here, you don't have any doubt, counsel, that your client's a dangerous person, do you? That's the question posed by the Chief Justice, to which the attorney, his name is J. Matthew Wright, responds, begins to say in any event, Your Honor, I would want to know more about what dangerous person means. Probably not the wisest thing for the counsel representing the defendant to say at the time. And the Chief Justice interrupts him and says, well, it means someone who's shooting, you know, at people. That's a good start, the Chief Justice says. And yes, that drew some uncomfortable laughter in the courtroom. Again, uncomfortable because of the seriousness of this matter, the seriousness of someone who has a domestic violence restraining order against them, still using a gun and not accepting the prohibition of the federal law for possession and use of a weapon. That perhaps was the only somewhat lighter aspect of an otherwise very seriously, appropriately serious discussion. Along the way, a lot of the justices recognizing that this case would not be one in which rights under the Second Amendment are expanded, they begin to attack once again Bruin. This notion that, again, according to the Supreme Court case of just last year, Clarence Thomas wrote, the government must identify an historical analog, he said, something in the history, something in the past that would justify this particular piece of restrictive legislation. So it doesn't have to be necessarily a historical twin, but somehow you've got to be able to look backwards and identify some basis upon which in our history, our nation's history, some history, there has been some basis for doing exactly what the federal Congress has done here. Well, we know well that in the history of our own nation, certainly the history of mankind on the face of this planet, the notion of domestic violence has not been commonplace. It is a much more contemporary concept, appropriately ensuring that domestic partners are not in fact victimized by their other partners. That's a concept now written into the law more recently, but not a part of our history, regrettably, not a part of recognizing in many of these cases, if not most of them, that women have been on the receiving end of domestic violence, and understanding the law needs to respond to that. That's what the federal government was all about, the Congress was all about, in saying that people who have domestic violence restraining orders imposed upon them shouldn't also be carrying and using the very weapons that could perpetuate that domestic violence against their partners. Supreme Court almost certainly going to embrace that fundamental notion, but at least two or three of the justices say now is the time for us to revisit, even 15, 16 months later, whether or not this look backwards in history under Bruin is right. And also noting along the way, as did Ketanji Brown Jackson and Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan, that's already producing all these various results around the country, variations in interpretations of Bruin. We're going to get to a couple of those in just a moment or so, that send mixed messages to America about what the Second Amendment does and does not mean. Some courts finding that there are historical precedents for modern legislation that does, in fact, control appropriately preserving our safety and security when it comes to guns in America. Others finding that there is no historical precedent for these kinds of things and therefore disqualifying convictions under those laws. We've got a patchwork around the country that continues to develop day after day. The court here this past week identifying a number of things that need to be fixed inside Bruin, the language of it, the intent of it, the purpose of it, and the Solicitor General herself arguing strongly that this is the opportunity now for the Supreme Court to draw back, if not completely rescind, Bruin in what it said about this standard. A significant case coming out of the Supreme Court, almost certainly happening in May or June. After oral argument, once again, the takeaway from all of this is the court will likely back away from this extreme position in Bruin, maybe give us some additional language that tempers that. As the New York Times has also noted, this is not the case. This is not the Second Amendment case that the Supreme Court probably wants to be affiliated with. A legitimate commentator said that Supreme Court does not want to be noted as being the court that establishes a guideline out there, or even a headline out there that says Supreme Court upholds gun rights of domestic abusers. That's an image. That's a statement. This Supreme Court, plainly based upon the oral argument of this past week, does not want to be a part of. And so predictably, we will see in May and June of next year what they do. But likely this past week that in Rahimi, we will not get a further extension of the Bruin caseload and the case precedent. We're instead going to get some limitation on that, or at a minimum, some articulation that this particular kind of federal restriction on the use of weapons when you have a domestic violence restraining order against you, that can stand. And that is a legitimate exercise of the legislative function in America. Significant case. We'll talk more about it down the road. We should also talk this morning about one of those cases invoking Bruin from our own Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago just this past week. Again, having to do with the implications of Bruin. The Seventh Circuit recently focused on whether a particular kind of weapon, in particular assault weapons, an assault weapon ban that had been established by the state of Illinois and the city of Naperville, both of those jurisdictions enacting bans on assault weapons in those jurisdictions, the state of Illinois generally and the city of Naperville, again, a southwestern suburb of Chicago, both of them banning these kinds of weapons, principally in the wake of the Highland Park shooting of July 4th of 2022. We're going to talk more about that in just a moment or so as well. Both of them establishing legislatively you cannot use these weapons in the state of Illinois and certainly that particular municipality as well. The majority opinion of the Seventh Circuit upholding
upholding that decision by the Illinois legislature on whether that type of weapon is in fact protected under the Second Amendment, finding that it is not. The opinion was written by a circuit court judge. Her name is Diane Wood, also joined in by another justice judge named Frank Easterbrook. Frank Easterbrook used to be, as did Diane Wood, a professor at the University of Chicago. Both of them, some of my instructors when I was there at the law school there in Hyde Park, both of them drawing a distinction between types of bearable arms that are commonly used for self-defense, making reference to Heller, and the types of weapons typically reserved only for military uses. As we have talked before, from my time in Iraq and certainly the exposure that all of you veterans have to these kinds of weapons, you know well that automatic weapons of these kinds are not intended for domestic uses. They're intended for as to be weapons of war. That's exactly what Judges Wood and Easterbrook said in their opinion of just this past week. Said this: the state of Illinois, in the legislation that lies at the heart of this case, has decided to regulate assault weapons and high-capacity magazines, a decision that is valid only if the regulated weapons lie on the military side of that line and thus are not within the class of arms protected by the Second Amendment. Several municipalities have done the same, affirming once again the capacity of those municipalities of the state of Illinois to impose a ban on assault weapons in the state of Illinois, just to the south of us here in the state of Wisconsin. Now, gun rights groups who are responding to this are promising to bring this case where? To the United States Supreme Court. And so this case may well end up among the docket in this term, perhaps a future term, determining whether the decision under Bruin of the majority of this three-judge panel of the Seventh Circuit is right or wrong. So we may hear this again, but it is reassuring to know that even under a Bruin regime, which is out there today, being the subject of discussion by the Supreme Court as late as last Tuesday, the Seventh Circuit finding under Bruin that there's a distinction between weapons of war that have no place on our domestic lands, our properties, our engagements with each other, and those things that do in fact are in fact military in operation, and finding that a ban of assault weapons in the state of Illinois is indeed constitutional. That comes out of the Seventh Circuit just this past week as well, promising from the gun rights groups more advocacy in opposition to what the Seventh Circuit has said just this past week. And so we know, I mentioned already, the Highland Park shooting of July 4th of 2022. And again, the fact that the Illinois legislators decided to impose that ban based upon the horror of what happened that day. Seven people, parade goers on July 4th, killed in that municipal area just to the south of us. Many others injured. We continue to hear about the catastrophic effects of that event in July 4th of 2022. We know as well that in the wake of that event, the local and federal authorities there have charged Robert Cremino III, a young man at the time who was a minor at the time. Now he's 19 years old. He is an adult, with not only those homicides, but also with federal offenses involving that assault, that horrific melee at the time. And as a result of that, again, we know that that case involving the actual shooter, the next hearing in it is scheduled for December 11th. Mr. Cremino III pleaded guilty to 21 first-degree murder counts, 3 for each person killed, 48 counts of attempted murder, and 48 counts of aggravated battery. Next court appearance, once again, in December 11th, coming up fairly soon. That case not yet at trial, a part of the pretrial proceedings going on right now. Along the way, what happened? What happened just this past week in a much related case? A lot of discussion, appropriately in America, in the wake of all this, about what about the people who may support the acquisition, the purchase of firearms by people who engage in this kind of horrific conduct? When we come back, we'll talk about the father of Robert Cremino III and his involvement with the federal and state justice system in Highland Park in Illinois and beyond right after this brief break, and we'll come back for that important discussion.
How I need.
This is 93.5 The Tap.
The RPG came through the belly of the aircraft. We don't talk about the female combat wounded. These are our daughters and our sisters and our mothers. Wounded Warrior Project came into my life and taught me how to stand back up and get back in the fight.
The truth is, I think we all have this strength inside of us, but until you're tested, you just don't know it's there.
See how Wounded Warrior Project empowers women veterans like Beth by visiting woundedwarriorproject.org/empowerwomenvets.
Earl Ingram.
If all the other things globally aren't enough to give us pause, healthcare premiums rose 8% this year. And so corporations are starting to feel the strain of offering health care to their employees, and more of them are abdicating that. What are people to do?
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings 8 to 10 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. You're listening to 93.5 The Tap.
Welcome back this morning, Saturday, November 11th, Veterans Day 2023, as we talk about firearms in America, some significant events going on in the state of Illinois, including this decision by our Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals to uphold a ban on assault weapons there, a case probably going to the Supreme Court. And now chatting about what happened on July 4th of 2022, this melee, this horrific event, taking the lives of seven people in Highland Park as a result of the use of one such weapon. What happened just this past week? Well, the father of the shooter of in that event of July 4th of 2022 pleaded guilty just recently to seven counts of misdemeanor reckless conduct after doing what? After helping his then teenage son, his son Robert, obtain a license to buy the firearms prior to that 2022 mass shooting, effectively giving him the authorization, the permission under the law to get the very firearms that resulted in the catastrophic assault upon the people of Highland Park, including those specific seven people and many others injured in that horrific event. The plea deal itself reduces the elder's crimes from various felony counts to which the 59-year-old defendant here would have faced up to 3 years behind bars. Instead, as a part of this resolution, he's going to spend 60 days in a county jail, 2 years probation, and surrender his own firearms identification card, a thing called the FOID card, and any other firearms or ammunition in his possession. Also prohibited, rightly, from sponsoring any future applications for minors for such a card, as he did for his own son. His jail sentence, the 60-day sentence, scheduled to begin this coming week. Again, the father of the shooter going to prison, finding by the court, by the prosecution, by our society, by our community, that there's responsibility for these kinds of behaviors beyond the shooters themselves. The shooter, again, going to trial probably sometime in 2024. That not yet resolved. The assumption, the presumption of innocence attends the now adult shooter. But his father pleading guilty for what he had done, getting a sentence that an awful lot of people are looking at and saying, gee, that doesn't sound very, very strict, very, very significant, and probably it is not. But it is nonetheless a first step in movement toward responsibility for people who facilitate, who support, who in any way encourage or assist in those people who would steal from us our safety and security through firearms to which they should not be given possession and certainly should not be using in America. Along the way, the prosecutor said this. This wasn't a fishing license. Again, speaking about the authorization given to the young shooter at the time. This wasn't a permission slip to go to the museum. This was a permission slip, the prosecutor said, for his son to buy an assault rifle. And when he signed this permission slip, he knew exactly how dangerous it was for this now 19-year-old to have a weapon. And that indeed is the lesson coming out of Highland Park, coming out of that particular prosecution just in recent days. A lesson, once again, as we've talked about deterrence, not only to the father here, who certainly will never do this again, but also to other people who might think twice, should think twice, about whether that they will support purchases by anyone else, sons, daughters, brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, mothers, fathers, who might otherwise be ineligible to purchase weapons. In this particular case, a father effectively purchasing a weapon for his son through the authorization given under Illinois law. Today, that father going to prison for the next couple of months for that specific conduct. And then we have one more entry into our focus this morning on firearms in America. It comes out of the Fifth Circuit. We've talked a lot about the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in the South there. The Fifth Circuit, contrary to the Seventh Circuit, again, consistent with some courts, inconsistent with others, as the Supreme Court has commented on just this past Tuesday, a federal appeals court of the Fifth Circuit finds that ghost gun limits are unlawful. What are ghost guns? Well, you know these well. Ghost guns are sold online as kits, and they require basically the purchaser to assemble them at home. You buy them online, you get them delivered, you assemble those guns at home. Because the parts of these so-called ghost guns are not considered functioning firearms, you can't use them in their disassembled way to shoot. They could be sold without serial numbers. In other words, the parts do not have serial numbers on them, and the purchasers are not required to undergo background checks, all the kinds of things that are in place in other circumstances to ensure that we know not only who's purchasing firearms, but the uses of those firearms under the Second Amendment will be lawful, as the Supreme Court has identified it in recent cases. In 2022, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, responsible for investigating and also regulating the use and the focus of these kinds of guns out there, updated the definitions of the terms firearm, frame, and receivers under something called the Gun Control Act of 1968, so that ghost guns would in fact be covered under existing laws. In other words, another federal rule in this case, under federal law, that basically prohibits your use of them under these circumstances. A three-judge panel of the Fifth Circuit, again based in New Orleans, ruled that the ATF basically overstepped its bounds, its authority, when updating this rule and prescribing those particular definitions. The circuit court judge named Kurt Engelhardt wrote that the ATF's rule on ghost guns, quote, flouts the clear statutory text and exceeds the legislatively imposed limits on agency authority in the name of public policy. In other words, the judge saying this is not consistent with the legislative enactment here, the rule by ATF, not proper, not constitutional under the Second Amendment, went on to say ATF, in promulgating its final rule, attempted to take on the mantle of Congress to do something with respect to gun control. This, according to the circuit court judge writing on behalf of the majority of the Fifth Circuit, but it is not the province of an executive agency to write laws for our nation. That coming out of the Fifth Circuit, again, finding that ghost gun limits are unlawful under federal law and under ATF rules. Now, the Department of Justice, that is again involved in all these cases, including Rahimi, Department of Justice through the Attorney General and through the criminal division there, is expected to appeal that decision. It's an important case coming out of the Fifth Circuit, just as other groups are going to be appealing almost certainly the Seventh Circuit case, as we described it before. This case almost certainly going to be appealed by the U.S. Department of Justice. Where? To the United States Supreme Court. And so adding even more to its docket that already has when it comes to firearms in America, this all-important focus upon what the Second Amendment means, what it doesn't mean. And again, consistent with what the Supreme Court has said just this past week, Bruin causing major confusion out there with this focus on history and no longer focusing on analysis based upon what keeps us safe and secure and whether the legislation passed by our legislators is intended to that end. When we come back, we're going to talk more about other things going on in the courts of America, including a court in New York City. Come back right after this brief break.
And he's talking with David, who's still in the Navy, and probably will be for life.
If anyone knows what's on tap, it's the Chippewa Valley. We're talking about everything that's on tap in your world today. 93.5, The Tap. Did you know this local radio station is part of Civic Media? Learn more about the entire network at civicmedia.us. Your hometown radio refreshed. This is the Civic Media Radio Network. Earl
Ingram.
Clearly, at this point, what is going on in Congress and the importance of the Speaker, that's always been a high-profile position, Sandy. Why can't we get that fixed?
The problem really comes down to the problem we have within the parties. Not only are we highly polarized between parties, but we seem to be highly polarized within party as well.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings 8 to 10 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Christopher Cruz. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is rejecting growing calls for a ceasefire in Gaza unless Hamas releases all 200.